Beth, and you're listening to It's All About Food, and it's the 15th of August, 2012. Thanks for joining me today, and we're going to have a lot to digest today, so I hope you're ready to do some serious chewing. We talk about food on this show and all things related to food, health, environment, animals, and I'm always learning something, which is one of the things that I enjoy most about doing this program, and I learned an awful lot from the last book that I just read, and I'm going to be talking about that today, and bring on the author of this book, Julie Guthman, got a PhD in geography from the University of California at Berkeley, and she's an associate professor in the Department of Community Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She has written extensively on contemporary activist efforts to transform the way food is produced, distributed, and consumed. Her book, Agrarian Dreams, The Paradox of Organic Farming in California, won the 2007 Frederick H. Boutelle Award for Outstanding Scholarly Achievement from the Rural Sociological Society. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Guthman.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking with you. I squirmed a lot reading your book.
Well, you're talking about weighing in, though.
Yeah, weighing in.
Yeah, because we just introduced Agrarian Dreams.
Oh, well,
which is my first book.
Yes, but the book that I just read was Weighing In.
Yes.
But, you know, we can certainly touch on everything else you've written before. I think it's all
Absolutely.
very informative and very necessary. So let's just start with Weighing In, which is Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism.
Yep. it's meant to make people squirm.
Yeah, well, I was. I admit it. But I learned a lot, and so we're going to talk about some of those things. So one of the things that I liked right away in the book was you talked about how all kinds of studies have been interpreted and perhaps misinterpreted, and as a result we've gotten this belief that we have this obesity epidemic, and you broke that down a little bit in terms of how we could understand how some of that may have come about. And one of the items was the BMI, the body mass index.
Yes, a lot of the statistics we hear about obesity really begin with the body mass index, which is the measure that we use to figure out if people are too fat or not. And the body mass index is basically a ratio of weight to height squared. And so
who came up with that? Do you know?
Excuse me?
Who came up with that? Do you have any idea?
Oh, you know, it originated, it's very interesting history, actually. It originated with this 19th century physician named Quetelet. He was French. Or he's actually Belgium, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very interested in deciding what average man looked like, and he did all sorts of calculations and noticed that this kind of ratio was constant.
Mm.
And so it was never intended to be, or he was just interested in averages. It was never intended to be a norm. It was just kind of an observation. And of course it was based on Belgians in the 19th century.
Right.
And so that later became used by the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company for actuary tables, and then it became the BMI, but again, it was never designed to be something that we should all aspire to. It became just a way of describing what's average.
Well, for me, it's
across
like
the population, most people would have that, you know, a particular kind of ratio.
It feels like a pantyhose size diagram to me when I look at some of those with the height and weight, and just like pantyhose, it never really fits right.
No, it doesn't, and that's the thing with the BMI. It's useful for epidemiological studies because the other ways of determining how much body fat we have are very expensive because they involve clinical measurements. It can be, you know, the kind of pinching people or having them float in water or these kind of new X-ray technologies, all of which have their strengths and downfalls. But the BMI you can use across a broad population because people can self-report them or they can be taken in everyday clinical measurements. So that's why it's become the preferred use of determining how big people are. But again, its origins was not about what ought to be. It was just descriptive of what is. It was about an average, not
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And the other thing about it is, of course, anything that makes you weigh more, even if it's muscle or higher bone mass, would increase your BMI. And so you have a lot of bodybuilders, for example, have high BMIs because they have a lot of muscle.
Right. So it's not really a clear indication of anything.
No, it's not a clear. It's an indication of bigness, but it's not a clear indication. It's an indication of weight to height.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
But not
that's what
to fat, and certainly not to whether fat is pathological or not, which is another issue.
Now, there have also been different studies that have come out, or different interpretations. Determining that we're having an epidemic, and some of that is related to the BMI number, because the boundaries of the BMI are just based on certain numbers, and we've moved those numbers around, and that affects our interpretation of where we are.
Right. So that's a great question. And so the way we understand that there's been a growth in bigness, and I don't deny that people have gotten bigger, and including
yes.
wider, but how that is expressed on it through the media can be quite exaggerated. So the way the BMI works is just an index, right? And so, a 25 BMI is, different than a 28 BMI. So the way that we understand that there's bigness, that there's a great sense of obesity, is how those things are categorized. And so we have people in the 20 to 25 BMI are considered normal, 25 to 30 are considered overweight, 30 to 40 are considered obese, and over 40 are considered morbidly obese. But depending on how tall one is, the difference between one level of BMI to the next is about 5 to 8 pounds. So if you, at any given point in time, if you had a large part of the population having a 29 BMI, and that would be in the overweight category, and over, let's say, 5 years, they all gained an average of 6 or 7 pounds, they would then, that huge swath of population would then fall into the next category of obese. And so all of a sudden it looks like there's a much larger number of obese people, even though the average weight gain is only, 5, 6, 7 pounds. So that's just like one of the ways in which the way these numbers are portrayed can really kind of overstate the issue.
But the point is, we do have an issue, and I think one of the themes in your book is what is causing us all to be bigger and wider.
Yeah, what is causing us, and it's not only what is, yes, one of these things is what is causing us, but also, is it the problem that we think it is?
Exactly. And so that's what we're going to talk about next.
Sure.
So, yeah. You mentioned the energy balance, and I loved that when I was back in engineering school. We talked a lot about energy balances, and it's pretty simple to understand. You take energy in with food, you burn it up with everything that you do in the day, and whatever you don't burn up, it kind of accumulates.
Right. That's the energy balance of, the idea that calories in excess of calories in rather than calories out is making us bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've written the book, I've just become utterly fascinated with calories, and there's some material I've pulled since writing the book that it's not in the book, but the calorie is actually doesn't inhere in food. We don't have molecules of calories in food. So there's an interesting question of why we think that calories are the best way to understand how bodies get bigger. But what the book does talk about is that there's some really important emerging evidence that suggests that there's these non-caloric pathways to obesity. And one of the most significant is the probable role of environmental toxins. And we're talking about agrochemicals, we're talking about probably the hormones that are used in beef cattle, even though very little's been studied about
mm-hmm.
that.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. We feed them these things to make them grow big and fat, and if
absolutely.
We eat it, why isn't it going to make us grow big and fat?
Absolutely, and what's really significant here is that the synthetic hormones that are given to cattle are analogs to DES, which is now banned, but DES is a synthetic estrogen that has been shown to cause increased weight gain in laboratory animals.
Well, some of the really scary things about this is that we don't see the impact immediately sometimes from some of these chemicals, and some of them actually take a generation or more to see the
right
impact.
That, and that's what I think is the really interesting piece of this environmental toxin.
Interesting and scary.
Really scary, really scary, because these things do act intergenerationally, and so I mean the history of DES is interesting in its own right. DES was a horrible thing. It was given to women in the 1950s and 60s to prevent miscarriage and to increase lactation, and the progeny of these women had much more susceptibility to various reproductive cancers and infertility. Infected a whole generation of children. And so that was an epigenetic effect, that the women themselves weren't adversely affected, or not in a big way, but their children were. And so it looks like what's happening with the environmental toxins is happening in the same way. So the exposures to these toxins in utero are manifesting in all these things when children are adults. I was thinking of animals. And so these exposure to a lot of these the experiments that have been done have exposed laboratory animals to various synthetic estrogens and seen that these animals are the same size as their non-exposed peers at birth, and then by the time they're adult, they can be 30% bigger. And so now there's this strong contention that this is what's happening with obesity rates. And it makes a lot of sense, too, because we know that these chemicals really started to proliferate in the environment in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and now we have this huge jump in body weights in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. It could very well be related to those kind of intergenerational effects of the toxins.
I think there's a lot of things going on with us physically, and we don't know, and it's so hard to know what the origin is of some of these issues. I just know from my own personal experience, I had advanced ovarian cancer 6 years ago, and at 48 years old, and when I think about how I possibly could have gotten it, I go far back as a teenager when I knew that I had problems, and I'm thinking, was that something I was born with that ultimately, through a variety of different pathways, got aggravated from dioxin and tampons and all kinds of other things? But I'm sure a lot of us with health issues have unique stories, because there's so many different chemicals out there.
Absolutely. And, we just know so little about it, and it's so understudied, because the chemical industry is not interested in having a study, and it is really frightening.
It is.
And a lot of the diseases that are associated with obesity, like diabetes type 2, well, there's now evidence that the environmental toxins are generating diabetes type 2, too, so where the obesity might be a symptom, it might not even be the causal agent, as people often assume. So, yeah, it's a pretty scary mix of chemicals we have out there in the environment.
I got my degrees in chemical engineering, and I feel kind of guilty that I know so many of my colleagues are participating in doing some really scary things.
Yep.
Okay. Now, I think that there definitely are so many different issues in making us unhealthy and making us overweight, but something is definitely true, and that is we are not eating the same as we ate 50 years ago. We're eating lots more cheese, high saturated fat. We're eating more meat. It may not be in the form of beef, but in the form of chicken. And we're eating less plant foods. And we know that that's not healthy.
Well, there's no question that we eat different than we did 50 years ago, but the way we ate 50 years ago was not so great. I think there's a lot of romance that suggests that we ate better, but we didn't. I mean, first of all, people were often undernourished,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of folks did not have a high fruit and vegetable diet as, there's kind of the yes, there's been a growth in more chicken produce, as you just referenced, but there's also much more fresh fruit and vegetable availability than there was before. So people ate, you know, people ate a lot of grains, and they ate worse cuts. I mean, they ate different cuts of meat. But I'm not, the evidence isn't there that people ate a whole lot more nutritiously. And in fact, the evidence suggests that they ate less nutritiously then.
Yeah, I remember reading.
So for me, the question is kind of the way the food is produced, the use of the agrochemicals, the use of the hormones and the antibiotics in the meat that's really bears much more attention. I just don't think we can kind of fantasize that diets 50 years ago were all that great. Remember, people had a lot of that Betty Crocker cake mix, you know.
Oh, I remember reading Aaron Bobo Strain's book on white bread and was...
He's a good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah, but I was so surprised to read, you know, some people got 30% of their calories from bread.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So we talked about chemicals and how scary they are, and let's talk about a lot of us think we're doing good things, and I know personally I feel so frustrated. I feel frustrated with the government for so many years now. I feel like that there's nothing that I can do or say that's going to make a difference in terms of the government. And so what I do is I live my life the best way I can. I buy organic. I go to farmers markets. I participate in CSAs. And I feel really good about that. And then in reading your book, there are some issues connected with all of these things that started me squirming.
Yes, that's the chapter that gets everything. Well, I do a lot of those things too, by the way, but I just don't think they're enough, and I think that they can even be problematic, and let me try to explain why. What you said is absolutely right. People don't think that there's any kind of thing that they can do through the government or through, they don't think there's a way to fight like what corporations do, so the way we've thought about changing the food system is pretty much through our own dietary choices, and the idea is if enough people make different sorts of choices and they buy organic or buy local, that somehow the market will grow and all the rest of the stuff will disappear, the bad stuff will disappear. And that's just not what's going to happen here, because a lot of the good stuff, and again, I support it too. I buy organic. I go to the farmers market. I think it's great food. But the whole way that's regulated is designed to cost more. I mean, the idea is that those who can afford to pay can go buy this stuff, and that's all great. And the whole system of organic certification, does not regulate what the most producers do. It says if you want to buy this stuff, if you think this stuff is more valuable, you can pay more for it. And that's, again, the system of organic regulation institutionalizes that by saying, if growers that abide by these particular standards and are willing to be inspected and get certified will be rewarded with higher prices. And so basically what that means is those who can't afford to buy all that stuff are left with to buy the rest of the stuff, and the rest of the stuff is unconscionably underregulated. So what we're getting is this kind of bifurcated food supply where we have some folks with money and will to do so getting some very high quality food, and the rest of the stuff is underregulated. So growers who do not want to abide by organic standards then go on to use whatever, the worst of the agrochemicals, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And that's what everybody else gets to eat. And so a lot of the point of the book is to really get us focused on the policy environment and thinking of how we can really leverage major changes so that all people can eat better, not just have some people buy their way out.
Well, I absolutely want everyone to be fed, and I want everyone to be fed with quality food. There's no question about that for me, and whatever I can do to participate in that, I am happy to do that. And I want to believe that by supporting with my dollars something that I believe in and more people that do, that business is going to grow. But at the same point, how do we get the regulations to change?
Well, you know, so many people have given up on the policy environment, and one of the things that the book does is suggest it's not even only our agricultural policies that we need to pay attention to. We do have, you know, we don't regulate our banks. We don't, in my opinion, we don't tax wealth enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have dramatic inequality, and so we have to kind of really address things at these kind of more structural levels, and including, you know, I mean, I think one of the ironies of the food movement is that it doesn't focus on food workers, and food workers are 38 million food workers in the United States, and, you know, people who go to farmers markets and buy all the local stuff, they care very much about the farmers, but we're not paying attention to farm workers or people who work in food processing or people who work in food distribution or people who work at Walmarts or people who work at, you know,
and they're paid very poorly.
McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And these are some of the poorest paid people around. And so we have theories of food system change that aren't really addressing people who work in the food system. So how we get there is, of course, really difficult. You know, I mean, I think one of the things that's going on in the world right now is we're kind of led to believe that there's change is impossible. And so people have really given up on change through contesting corporate behavior or through policy. But I don't think there's a way around it, because I know that all of us buying our way, you know, one meal at a time through local food systems isn't going to cut it, because it neglects so many people who don't have the option to do that.
Well, another book that I read a while ago is Tomato Land, Barry Esterbrook, and I always say now that every food has its own story, and the tomato has a frightening story, especially in Florida where it's grown, and there are workers there that are treated like slaves, and it really opened up my eyes to what's going on all around the country, you know, where we really think we have this freedom, and then there are so many people, whether they are really enslaved or close to it, there are so many people that are bringing food to our plate that, you know, there's slavery and pain and suffering in every bite of our food.
Absolutely. And pesticide exposure, I might add.
It's a what?
And pesticide exposure.
Oh, yeah. Now, the only
farm workers are exposed to constant pesticide drift, and they have terrible health problems because of it. And are the ones that, you know, again, this focus on what people eat, and so there's, you know, a lot of discussion about Latinos are getting fatter because they're adjusting to American diets, but a lot of Latinos that are working in construction and particularly farm work are exposed to chemicals on a daily basis, and that may be the cause of some of their bodily changes, their weight gain. So,
but at least the one thing I feel good about with eating organic is that the workers that are growing that food are not exposed to those horrible chemicals.
They're not exposed to the worst of them. They're exposed to for instance, they use sulfur in organic production, and sulfur doesn't kill you. It just causes irritation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, detail. Okay.
So people who work on organic farms tend to not have as worse exposure. They can still have poor pay and working conditions, but
absolutely
not as many of the exposures.
Oh, now, do you think we can move to a place where most of our food will be made organically? Is that a big leap of faith?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's organic and there's organic. I think that there's, you know, the kind of deep organic that it's completely agroecological is not practices as far and wide, but you know, there's broader interest in more sustainable production techniques, and a lot of major food corporations are getting involved in organics. And I certainly think it's technically possible, although difficult to grow, to employ some agroecological methods on large scale, because you can't kind of monocrop. So I think it's possible, but it's certainly possible for organics to grow more than it does, but I just think that the way to do that is not through kind of this voting with your dollar, but through policies that encourage more sustainable production and discourage the kind of the more industrial production, and that takes a big change in the policy arena. It means, for instance, outlawing particular pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
When I did my research for Agrarian Dreams that you mentioned, I learned that a lot of producers had gotten into organics not because they believed it was, the greatest thing since sliced bread, but because they were really worried about having particular pesticides regulated away, and they figured they needed to figure out what they were going to do. And so
that's pretty smart.
Yeah. So there, you can have. Pesticide regulation can be technology forcing. It can force growers to employ different sorts of methods. And maybe they're not the purest organic methods, but they can be less toxic. And so I guess I would like to see more policies that have wider reach that maybe aren't as purist. Those can be done, and it can be done through changing the way we subsidize agriculture. It can be done, again, through pesticide regulation. It can be done through more attention from the public universities that do research extension and extension on sustainable methods rather than agrochemical methods. So those are all things that, take policy changes, but they're very doable.
Now, we need to be doing what? Writing and calling our elected officials and letting them know how we feel?
We need to be doing that. We need to be changing the conversation, the public conversation, say that we do need focus on policy, that buying and doing, our own self-practices of how we buy and what we do is not enough. I mean, again, the public conversation is such a big piece of this. People, if people don't believe they can have a make a difference, they won't be able to make a difference.
That's right.
We need to, there have been some interesting victories in, but they don't get a lot of attention. But for instance, methyl iodide.
Oh yeah. We should watch that.
Highly, highly toxic fumigant that was released on the market to replace methyl bromide. Methyl bromide is an ozone depleter and it's supposed to be phased out. Well, methyl iodide was far more toxic and was believed to cause birth defects among people exposed to it. Well, there was a big public outrage, and it was withdrawn from the market because it wasn't seen as economically viable. It's actually something I'm doing research on right now of how that exactly came down. Well, that took effort, but it worked.
Yeah, that was very good news. The thing is,
yeah.
Methyl bromide isn't so great either, and we're supposed to be phasing that out. And
it's supposed to be done in 2 years, but
good luck.
Yeah, well, that's what research I'm doing right now, actually, is what's going to happen with that. But
okay,
yeah,
well,
so
I hope you figure out.
Do happen.
I hope you figure out the recipe to get those things done.
But it was also interesting about the methyl iodide fight. It wasn't the usual it wasn't the usual suspects. It was groups that were acting with and on behalf of farm workers. And so, those regulatory battles can matter, and they can, and if there's enough of those that happen, then people start believing differently about what's politically possible.
Now, in your book, it all seems to come down to some really fundamental problems like capitalism.
Yeah.
And so you take a deep breath and you go, oh my God. All this to get good food on my table, but, capitalism. I mean, how does that come into play with what's
on
the
plate? Well, capitalism comes into play in all of these things. I mean, we live in a world right now where we are led to believe that we need to let business have its way for us to all live the good life, and business shouldn't be regulated, business shouldn't be taxed, and somehow if money's made, it'll somehow trickle down to everybody else. I mean, this is the public conversation right now, particularly if you listen to the Republicans, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What that's meant is we have a world of tremendous inequality, unregulated industries. So we have all these chemical outputs coming, that we're being exposed to on a regular basis. And we do not, in my opinion, tax enough so that we can redistribute some of the tax money to have more public services, to have, for instance, Better food assistance, so people can afford to buy, so those who do not have jobs can afford to buy better food. So all those things are, you know, basically about keeping capitalism afloat, which is very crisis prone, as we know, you know, firsthand right now, because we're in a significant crisis of capitalism. And all these kind of things about reducing taxes and deregulating, all about trying to restore profitability. But it's quite debilitating. So I do think we need to look very hard at capitalism for us to really get to a more sustainable food world.
Yes. There's got to be something after capitalism.
Right, and we don't know what it is, and the biggest trap is most of the socialist experiments of the 20th century weren't too pretty, and so that's what people say, well, that didn't work, but we just don't know what it is, but we need to move to someplace different. Sometimes my students will say, well, what's your vision? I say, well, you know, when capitalism started emerging in 1450, people didn't envision that it would be as it is in the year 2012. I mean, it emerged. It was just a different way, a different logic of how goods and services are produced. And so I think it's just, I think the key is just finding ways that are different to hope that they build. But not, you know, again, not believing that's the only way, that capitalism's the only way, that it's inevitable.
Right.
Because capitalism is, you know, capitalism is not doing so well on its own terms. Major crisis.
There's
and who knows what's really going to happen anyway.
I know. We don't know. And what's scary, it's very scary in many ways, but, I imagine our food supply will definitely be affected. And many of us who have not experienced shortages will... I don't even want to even imagine what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's really hard to know. Certainly, with a lot of crops going to biofuels these days, which is again is a kind of another fix for capitalism, rather than rethink how we use energy, we use more and more crops are going to biofuels. Well, that's certainly affecting crop prices, and right now, there's a possibility of shortage, although for the most part. There's been an excess of food, and that's been one of the problems. That's a long, tricky conversation.
Yeah. I wanted to get back a little bit more about obesity, but we need to take a break. Do you have a little bit more time where we can come back and talk
sure.
a little bit more? Great.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll take a quick break, and we will be right back.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you so much for listening. And I am talking today with Julie Guthman, the author of Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. She's the author of Agrarian Dreams, The Paradox of Organic Farming as well. And these are books that must be read. There's so much important information, and we're talking a little bit about some of that right now. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that calorie.
Okay.
And I'm one of those alternative food promoting healthism people that you talk about in the beginning of your book that has never really had a weight problem. And I'm really quite exuberant about promoting the power of something that I believe in, which is eating a lot of healthy plant foods, local, organic. I am a vegan for a long time, and I came to that because I don't believe in killing animals. And I just wanted to say there's certainly a lot of diets out there, and I know a lot of people struggle with food. My partner, he was 100 pounds overweight, and he had been on many diets all of his life. None of them worked, and he's now at peace with the foods that we're eating, and, you know, he looks great and he feels great. So, I have some firsthand experience with food and weight. One of the things that I think is a piece in the obesity equation is that many people are eating empty calories or eating calories that are not bringing them the nutrition that they need, and their brains are starving.
Yeah, you know, this particular book doesn't go very much into nutrition per se, but this is something that I've gotten even more curious about since I've read the book, because the newer kind of nutritional science is contesting the calories in, calories out model for other reasons too, that calories just don't quite get at the kind of different qualities of different foods. And, you know, it's not only the different qualities of different foods, there's research that suggests that when we eat is not as important as what we eat, but it's certainly important. Eating the first thing in the morning can help one lose weight, so it said. And so I'm with you that I do think food quality matters. I think some dietary fats have gotten a bad rap. And we know that, you know, there's a lot of evidence right now that suggests that carbohydrates are more of a problem. And so if you look at it from a calorie perspective, you would want to eat more carbohydrates than calories.
You want to eat good carbohydrates.
I'm with you. I mean, I agree that nutrition matters, and what kind of foods we eat matter. And it's not only about calories. I think where I and I'm with you that the thing is that there's so many other things that are affecting weight gain. Some of it's genetics, some of it has to do with all these different ways in which some people have faster or slower metabolisms, and some has to do with these toxins that I've been discussing. I think the problem I have with nutrition is not the content of nutrition. I think it's interesting stuff, but I think is that those who eat well tend to kind of proselytize to others about how to eat, and it's just not effective. It's just not an effective strategy. I think most people know what they're supposed to eat, and they eat what they eat for other reasons.
We definitely need a change in education about food.
I missed what you said. I'm sorry.
I agree. Proselytizing is never a good thing, and but we know so little about food today. We're so detached from it, and people need, well, I don't know that we've ever really understood much about food, especially in my reading about history, what people thought was good for them. But I think we need to have some better education about food, and maybe the regulation is a part of that.
Yeah, I would say more regulation, because I think that so much of focus on food politics right now is trying to get people to change what they eat, and we don't focus very much at all on how food is produced. If we change how food is produced, and we say that certain sorts of things like trans fats, for example, shouldn't be allowed, then they shouldn't be allowed. And so we need to have a public conversation of what sort of things are unthinkable to have people eating, rather than ask people to individually make choices when individually they have all sorts of reasons for eating what they want, including affordability, including pleasure. And so, you know, the food education, I'm not sure about that. I think that that's one of the it gets a lot of attention because it's something that it feels doable. You know, I work with students who want to change the food system, and they all want to do food education because that's something they can imagine doing. It goes back to what's politically possible. They can imagine going to an elementary school and doing nutrition education and cooking classes. They can't imagine, you know, going to Monsanto or whatever and saying you actually need to not, you know, we're gonna do some action or whatever until you don't use genetically modified organisms. I mean, I'm not convinced that food education works. I think it feels good because it feels possible. But I'd rather our efforts be focused on changing how food is produced than trying to convince consumers to eat differently.
Okay, so here
I think most people know what they're supposed to eat.
Yeah,
they really
probably
do.
Yeah. Here we are in this trickle-down society, and there's a lot of nonprofits out there struggling to do well. I know I have one. And you look for grants to support your cause, and you always have to craft the grant in order to fit what it is they're trying to fund. And a lot of it is for obesity or for children's nutrition or maybe for people in poverty. And so that's probably another reason why we see a lot of focus on obesity. It's kind of like a catch-22. It exists, but the money that's there is focused on what to do about it. There's really a bigger picture.
Absolutely. I think that with the foundation world and the nonprofit world, we've got kind of the tail wagging the dog. Certainly philanthropists love to fund this sort of stuff because they love funding things where they can feel like there's results and where it's hands-on. And so you have a lot of organizations, and the obesity epidemic seems to have some sort of cachet that, you know, philanthropy wants to fund these food projects that are supposedly going to reduce obesity. And because of the way, you know, nonprofit status is set up, that it has to be charitable and educational, you can't get funding to, you know, to lobby government to contest the pesticide. And so there's all sorts, you know, there's all sorts of ways in which the philanthropic world and the nonprofit work helps drive what's possible in political change.
Ergo, a lot of frustration.
Right.
Okay. Well, it's really been great talking to you. Any pearls of wisdom before I let you go?
Oh. Pearls of wisdom. I just really want to encourage your listeners to think hard about the policy world and recognize that eating our way to change is not going to do it. As much as I like good food, too.
Yeah, we're all foodies. Okay, well, Thank you so much for joining me, and it's all about food, and thank you for writing this book, Weighing In. And I squirmed, and I'm glad I did.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me on the show.